It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimera's Comics. Chimera's is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimera's Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. It has taken 48 years, but the Batman 66 series is finally coming out on DVD and Blu-ray. It's all anyone's talking about, but I wanted to hear it from the man who knew the most about the series. So I talked to Joel Eisner. Now, Joel in the 80s wrote the official Batman Batbook. It was the first episode guide ever done of this series with trivia and interviews and capsules. And it was invaluable. I got it in high school, and I've kept it to this day. It's on my shelf next to Dark Knight Returns and Arkham Asylum and the classic Batman books. You have to remember, when he wrote this book, there was no internet. So there was no epguides.com. There was no tv.com. If you didn't have this book, you didn't know how many episodes there were. This book was the only way to find out. So it was invaluable. So I wanted to talk to Joel about writing the book. And he gave me so much more. This is one of the longest episodes we've ever done, just because he had so many great stories to tell. I learned things about the series that I didn't know, even watching it my entire life. And I tell you, if you thought it was hard to get these DVDs out, wait till you hear what Joel had to do to write this book.
Well, the show came on in January of 66. I was about 6 and a half.
Do you remember it?
Very funny about this. I was a Lost in Space fan. I still am. Mm-hmm. And Lost in Space started in September of 65. And it was on opposite Batman in January. And, well, Lost in Space was an hour. Batman's a half an hour. And I remember, because I never forgot this, because I was living in Trump Village in the Coney Island area at the time. And I was on the 7th floor. I had a friend on the 17th floor. And he got the first color TV set. We had all our friends who had a color TV set. So I went up there on Wednesday nights, and he had an older brother. I mean, I was 6 and a half, you know, but they wanted to watch Batman. And Lost in Space was still black and white. And so that's my first thing on Batman. I remember watching, the one I remember watching the first time was Mr. Freeze. I don't remember that. I remember watching the Catwoman episode later on there. But I remember Mr. Freeze thing because I remember after it was over, I went back downstairs to my apartment and watched the other half of Lost in Space. And that was the episode called Ghost in Space with the invisible alien on the planet that Dr. Smith thought was his ghost of his dead alien uncle.
Now, but you were, as you said, you were already reading the 12 Cent comics. Were you reading Batman back then, or was...
You know, it's funny. I'm going back in my head now, my old collection, and when I was little, I remember of it. And I had a lot of the Gold Key stuff. They had a lot of TV comics, and I had some of DC's alternate stuff they used to put out. The Sea Devils, the Challenges of the Unknown, the Doom Patrol.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the more obscure stuff.
Well, I didn't even have the monster stuff in it. You know, back then, monster stuff was very big. And then I had those, and I had some of the Gold Key, and then I had some of the Marvel stuff, I remember. Most of the few Tales to Astonish of the Hulk and the Tales of Suspense with the Captain America and the Red Skull and things like that. Because back then, you weren't around then, but Marvel had cartoon shows of the five main heroes that were on every day of the week. Captain America, Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, and Submariner. Every night at 7 o'clock on Channel 9.
Yeah, I saw those in reruns in the 70s, and it was the actual comics cut up and moving around.
Something like that. It was made by the same people who made the Spider-Man cartoon for ABC, which I think is the best of all the Spider-Man cartoons they've ever done, the ones they did in the 60s. It was interesting. It was an American company, but the voice actors were all Canadian.
Uh-huh.
And they were the same people who worked on the Rankin-Bass specials like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and things like that. And in fact, the guy who did the voice of Thor also did Mysterio in the Spider-Man cartoon. They did the same voices and the same thing, but he was also one of the stars of the Friday the 13th TV show. Hmm. A guy named Chris Wiggins, who was Jack Marshak. You ever see the TV show?
In the 80s, right?
Yeah, the one where they're trying to get back to Chris Antiques.
Yeah, it was around
the two kids, and he's the guy with the beard. He was the one who did all the voices.
He was the older character, yeah.
Yeah, he's still around. He did all the voices in a lot of those cartoon shows.
I remember that. It was around the same time as like Tales from the Dark Side and Freddy's Nightmares. There were a bunch of horror shows late nights.
They were all made for syndication. That was all done by, most of it was Paramount, but they did them all for syndication.
Yeah.
They shot that show in Canada, so it was easy. You know, very quickly, if you shoot a show in Canada because of the union regulations, the guest stars, even if you bring them in from America, or the cast members, you bring them in from America, they don't get, unless it's in their contract, they're not entitled to any kind of residuals from the reruns.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rerun money, so they get a fast, bigger check, but they don't get anything else. That's why a lot of shows eventually start there and come back to America, because the actors want more money. But I used to watch those shows, and then, of course, we had the Spider-Man cartoon, and then we had the Hanna-Barbera Fantastic Four cartoon.
I love those. Yeah, those
and then of course all the Hanna-Barbera Space Ghost and Frankenstein Jr. and the Impossibles and all the other cartoon superhero stuff. So we had a lot of superhero stuff going on at the time. So I would get all like the tie-ins to those show stuff, and I was doing, and we had the reruns of the Adventures of Superman show, which was on then too, and they were even, you know, they were doing even dumb cards back in the '60s for the old show. So we had a lot of superhero merchandise that started with it, but I was, like I said, I was more into the science fiction and the monster movies, and the gods. I was in the Godzilla thing. I mean, I was about 4 or 5 years old. I remember seeing my first horror picture on television, which is The Monster That Challenged the World.
Oh wow!
An old 57 giant sea slug movie, is a creature with Hans Conried and a couple other people, but it was a hydraulic creature they created. But so I was watching a lot of the old the monster pictures and the Godzilla pictures and all that kind of stuff. Batman sort of, to me, I mean, I was only reading the comic books that had, you know, the odd-looking covers to it, or it looked like it was a very, you know, interesting story. I had some of the Superman comics and stuff. So for me, you know, I mean, even when I wrote the Batman book, I mean, I'm still a more Lost in Space fan than I am a Batman fan.
Now, what
you see, Lost in Space and Batman are so close together. For many reasons, it's very difficult to separate them. If you like, I'll explain.
Please do.
First of all, they were both made by the same studio, which is the first thing. Back in the 60s, Fox was one of the biggest TV producers at the time. And they had a huge studio, which doesn't exist anymore. It was torn down for a housing development called Century City because they went bankrupt over the Cleopatra movie in the 60s.
Right.
And they wound up having to sell off the land. But back then they had a huge factory of stuff, and they were doing, back in that, between 65 and like 68, you had Batman, Lost in Space, The Green Hornet, Time Tunnel, Voyage of the Sea. They were just starting a Land of the Giants. You had the Planet of the Apes movie. You had the two James Coburn and Flint movies were being filmed, Fantastic Voyage. Dr. Doolittle was being done at the time also, the original version. Plus, they had 12 O'Clock High, they had several other, they were finishing up, Perry Mason was being filmed, they had all these other fantastic things that were being filmed, all these special effects, all these pilot films were being done to things. So the entire place was literally a factory of all these people, and they all used the same makeup department, the same, everyone, they had their own little in-house, didn't farm anything out. The only thing that was farmed after was Batman, because at the time, they ran out of studio space. So some of the Batman sets were at Fox, the rest was at Desilu, which was used to be RKO.
Right, Desilu did Star Trek.
Desilu did Star Trek, that's what bankrupted at Lucy.
Really?
Desilu was owned by Desi Arnaz and Lucy LaBeouf. And then after they divorced, he sold his share of the company to her, but he stayed on, made a few shows for them. And they had made The Untouchables and The Mothers-in-Law and a few other programs. And Lucy was in charge of Star Trek at the time. She was running the studio. And they warned her not to do a science fiction show because it was very expensive. And there wasn't much of a... they didn't think back in the 60s, there wasn't much in the way of reruns. We had very little reruns back then. It was mostly old movies, and a lot of old sort of... pseudo sitcom reruns, leftovers, you know, like things like Leave It to Beaver, which was Donna Reed's show, for like the Ozzie and Harriet and the My Little Margie and all the little black and white things they'd run in the mornings before the game shows. But there was no other real reruns outside of, you know, Lucy and maybe Burns and Allen and a couple other things. So, and as far as science fiction shows, Twilight Zone was still being filmed in the early 60s. Out of Limited just finished up, but so there was nothing to put into reruns, and they told her that you're not going to make the money with this thing, but she invested money into it, and she wound up having to sell the studio to pay the cost of for that stupid program.
Wow, and she never made it back with the syndication from Star Trek?
She sold everything to Paramount, made her money back that way. Paramount bought it up, and they lucked out with it, but they didn't realize they lucked out with it until after the show was a hit in reruns, after she sold it in the studio.
Yeah, and Paramount has it to this day. They're producing the J.J. Abrams.
Only because of the fact that she sold out to them.
Hmm.
And that's only because she lost so much money in the studio, she couldn't keep the studio going.
Wow.
Which is why the rest of her program, she started the Lucy Show, the Here's Lucy Show
right.
at Paramount, and then moved to Universal. Because she took the show with her.
Wow.
Otherwise, she was doing everything there. But that's the history of that stuff. Now, Lost in Space was the second show from after Voyage to Bombacita that Irwin Allen had done. And he was always been a schlock producer, but I always loved the junkie part. The Lost World and 5 Weeks in a Balloon and Story of Mankind and all this big circus, all the things he did. And he was basically, as he was referred to as Cecil B. DeMille on a Sam Katzman budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Cecil B. DeMille, you know, did Ten Commandments, was did all these big epics. Sam Katzman did these low-budget pictures at Columbia. Everything from The Giant Claw to Earth versus the Flying Saucers. In fact, he gave Harryhausen some of his early pictures to work on. So you had all this going on. Now, the casting directors on Batman and Lost in Space was basically the same guys. They went back and forth. One of them was a guy with the name of Larry Stewart, who was working on Batman. He went back to Lost in Space. He originally started the last season of Twilight Zone, and he would bring all the same people with him. Then he eventually went over to another studio. The other guy who was working as the casting director of Star Trek is a guy named Joe DiAgusta, and DiAgusta was fired. He was working on, in fact, at Fox. He was working at Batman. He was working on the shoes, and he went over to Paramount and started casting for Star Trek and Mission Impossible. That's why everybody was moving back and forth, the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Guest stars, cast members, everything. But on top of that, you see, the sound stages for Batman and Lost in Space were very close together, at least as far as the villains and the other stuff. The Batcave was a Desi Lu. In fact, the Batcave was sitting on the set from King Kong back in 1933. I learned that from one of the guest stars, and Joey Tater told me. He said he was doing Batman, and one of the little crew members were still working there from RKO. And the Batcave was located on the exact same soundstage, exact same location as the giant gate that they had built to represent where King Kong was going to burst through on Skull Island.
Wow. Well, they said that Batcave set was the largest television set at the time, so it makes sense.
Well, it was an $800,000 set.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how large it was physically, you know, square footage-wise or compared to some of the other things, because a lot of the stuff that Irwin did, he had the Jupiter 2 on Lost in Space on two different sound stages, top half and the lower half were two separate sets.
Really?
The Sea View was one big set on the entire sound stage. It sort of opened up into pieces. The Time Tunnel was this huge thing. It was made out of concrete. They actually built this thing to last, which was a huge set. So, I mean, I can't compare them. I wasn't there to see it, but... It was a massive set, but it was an expensive set, and so these things were meant to last. But back then, the whole thing between the whole camp period of television wasn't so much from the comic books. It was because of Batman. It was because of the Beatles. It was because of all the stuff that was going on in the 60s, and you know, psychedelic stuff and all those other things that went on, and it became sort of a fad, an over-the-top situation that people with the Batman caught on to, and it started affecting the other programs. As if it was Lost in Space and Batman were the same studio,
mm-hmm.
and they knew what was going on, so they started lightening up the program a bit. And then, of course, Jonathan Harris ran away with the show, but that was his doing. But
right, and they went into color later in their run, and they got
that's another technical problem, because back in that time period, there were two formulas of doing color television. Two different, it's like VHS and Beta.
Mm-hmm.
Two different ways of doing color. One was NBC was doing it, one CBS was doing it. And they were trying to get an industry standard out of it. And it wound up being regulated into the fact that the NBC's formula for doing color television, the process, was the one that was chosen for the regular broadcast area. ABC stayed out of it because they had no involved. But CBS, at that time, the CBS president, William Paley, and David Sarnoff, the head of NBC, were at odds with each other. And Paley refused, as long as he could, not to have to pay a licensing fee for the color process to NBC, which is why CBS stayed longer in black and white than the other two networks.
Really?
Yeah. But eventually they were forced into it. But so they only did it at first with the half-hour shows, and then the color shows went over to do it. But ABC went right to color in 66 with everything. Mm-hmm. Only the shows that went started in 65 stayed in black and white, like the first season of F Troop and things like that. But other than that, everything else went completely color. And you know, color TV was a big thing back then because they didn't have it. They had been doing color TV shows since the 1950s, but nobody ever saw it. Mentioned Superman, half the show was color. Bonanza was always shot in color going back in the 50s. The last few seasons of The Lone Ranger and Cisco Kid and all those other shows were all shot in color. And that's because of the company that made the color programs anticipated reruns eventually in color. But
yeah, in a way, it's a lot like high def in the late 90s. Like Fox started experimenting. I remember The X-Files went high def at a time when nobody had flat screens.
Well, because they anticipated it. They knew what was coming down the line as it was special effects. The cameraman from Batman was a guy named Howard Schwartz, and he's one of the two directors of photography on the show, and he told me he used to work as a cameraman on The Adventures of Superman. So there's a Superman connection there. And he told me, he said that the last couple of years of Superman, they shot them in color. Half the show was in black and white, half the show was in color. And they did it at a place called Ziv TV. And it was named after a guy named Robert Ziv, Z-I-V, who came up with the idea of shooting these TV shows in color. He said he was notoriously cheap because he spent all the money on the color process. but meanwhile, the guy was proven correct that these shows were much. Once the shows went from black and white to color, nobody wanted to watch much black and white anymore. So he foresaw what was going to happen. So a lot of times they do this. It's funny that way, but they do.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
I've often wondered, you mentioned psychedelia in the 60s, and I often wondered if that whole Summer of Love 67 and the bleeding, colorful posters like the Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead. I often wondered if color TV had an influence on that, just because the idea of color was coming into people's homes.
Well, probably that, and a whole bunch of the other people were into tie-dye stuff, a lot of bright color stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had been very dark and gray and reserved during the Kennedy years in the White House, I think. They were fashionable, but very stiff.
Yeah.
And all this other stuff, they went as far as they could do. Now, when Batman came in, they put all those bright colors in. And they were using every gel color on the book on the lights.
Right.
And it drove the cameraman crazy because nobody would, the cast members would be turning colors. But they were putting all the different gels on the lights. I mean, Cesar Romero told me, he said, now that wig he wore as the Joker was a bright green. But every time they filmed, they said it came out another color.
Yeah, I remember it looks yellow in a lot of the episodes.
Yellow, in the pilot, in the first one he did, it looks red.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, they learned that when they shot it outside, you could actually see it was bright green. Even in the movie, it looks almost like sort of an off-orange yellow.
Right.
But that's because of the color of the lighting gels they were using. They said it was always the same wig, so it's a lighting problem. But then they had the same problem with that on Next Generation Star Trek, with Data.
Yeah, yeah, he was...
He was gold.
And he never looked it. He always looked
white. No, because the lighting washed him out.
Yeah, I think the only time you can really see it is in Generations, where they use a much darker lighting scheme. Like everything's yellows and oranges, and you can actually see the speckled gold on his skin. But you're right, he always looked white.
Yeah, he always looked with him. They said that was the problem because of the hot, bright lights they needed for the program washed out the makeup. The same way Spock was tinted a little green, but you never saw it.
Right, yeah. And I think finally when the Blu-rays came out, I saw it a little bit.
I'm really disappointed. But, I mean, I don't have Blu-ray, but I'm really disappointed with what Paramount did with the Star Trek episodes. They went back and remastered all the special effects.
Yeah, but the thing I liked about those is they give you the choice when you load up an episode. You can see the old effects on the Blu-ray if you want to.
No. I'm talking about when they run it on MeTV. I don't think it's MeTV.
Oh, I do get MeTV, but, okay. I have the Blu-ray, so I'm usually not watching the reruns.
They run those episodes. And you could see where they... I mean, I remember they still use the old traveling mats, and you could see when the print started to get red on Channel 11, you could actually see the shuttlecraft just moving frame for frame for frame, because you can actually see the mat move.
Right.
Because now they took all that stuff out. Now the shuttlecraft doesn't just fly out. It turns side. It does everything it did in Next Generation. It gets all that little swerving around stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot more angles.
The show looked better because the problem is the rest of the show looks cheap compared to it.
Right. Yeah, that was always my
I don't see the point of it.
Yeah, the Enterprise comes up and it looks beautiful, and then you go into the Enterprise and you see the cheap plywood and you see the brush strokes on the paint.
Yeah. So, they went back and they remastered Devil, well, not the Doomsday Machine, and the inside of that cone shaped thing used to have that nice sort of speckle look to it. Now it's got like this pulsating thing to it. It looks terrible.
Yeah.
Because you know what the old stuff looks like. But I'm going off topic. I go all over the place. I've been a fan of all this stuff for a long time.
That's all right. That's what the show does.
Oh, no. I mean, but Batman to me and Lost in Space were very close, as I said. Because, again, as I said, a lot of the people from one show went to the other show.
Yeah, it's ironic that they were on it. It's ironic they were on against each other.
That was unfortunately timing, actually, what happened. I don't know whether ABC did it deliberately or not. They put it on Wednesday or Thursday. Now, they originally actually planned to do the show. They had a plan to either do it as an hour show once a week, then the 2 half-hour, which they did originally, which is what they came down to, or they were actually planning to do it 4 15-minute episodes a week.
Really?
Yeah.
It's almost like a series. Like the
old movie series. Yeah. Of course, what they're going to put on the other 15 minutes, I don't think they had an idea. But the script was originally broken up, the original pilot script that Lorenzo Semple wrote for the Riddler, was broken up into 4 15-minute segments with recaps at the beginning of each part.
Hmm. And so basically where the commercial break would have been the end of the show.
Probably, yeah. They would have had each time with another cliffhanger. They sort of did away and rearranged everything, decided to go for twice a night, which had never been done before for the half-hour segments. It's a very interesting thing about this whole series. You know, it's taken almost 50 years to bring this out on DVD.
Right.
And I'm still rather surprised by the whole thing because it's been a rights issue ever since the beginning. And as far as I'm concerned with this thing, it's a little too little too late that they waited that long to straighten this thing out. But it's only because of the fact that nobody knew who owned it.
Right. Well, at the time 20th Century Fox produced it, Warners didn't own DC Comics. They were still National and they were on their own.
Yeah.
So it's when Warners got involved that it became so complicated.
Well, that was, what 77, 70, some of the late 70s they took over.
Yeah, around the time of the Christopher Reeve Superman.
Yeah, but I'll tell you a little story which most people are not aware of. There's a backstory to my Batman book. This goes back to 1984. And after Neil Hamilton, there was Commissioner Gordon died. He was in his late 80s. He was sick. I mean, you know, but I said, look, if I'm going to do this book, which I wanted to do. I had done an episode guidebook to situation comedy shows, and I wanted to do an individual show. I wanted to do Lost in Space, and I wanted to do Batman. And back then, there was no internet. There was barely videotape or anything else to have all these things and, you know, reruns. So you had nothing else as far as reference. So a lot of these film TV books were coming out, and I had known a couple of people who had done a couple of books and stuff, and I said, well, I'm going to do this show. And I decided to pursue it. So I had written to 20th Century Fox to find out about the rights to Batman and Lost in Space. And they wrote back to me and they said, we don't have the rights to Lost in Space or Batman to do a book. So from there, I went to William Dozy, the producer. Now, I was at Planet Fortunes, and back then there was a thing called the Autograph Collector Society. Basically, it was a retired postal worker who had been compiling all the home addresses of all the celebrities in Hollywood. Yeah. He would sell the list every year. I don't know if he's still alive or he's still doing it, but this went for many, many years. And Dozier, I knew it was an authentic address because his address was Greenway Avenue, which was the production company for Batman.
Right.
And he had named it after his street where he lived on. So he was still there. So I wrote to him. He wrote me back. He said that he didn't have the licensing rights for the Batman show anymore. He had gotten out of the business. He retired. And says, okay, now this was late 84, so I was doing this into 85, and December 85 now, And then, so I said, okay, fine. Where do you go from here? DC Comics. I don't place else to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still in the open, not in Northern California, but back then it was on 666 Fifth Avenue. Never forgot the address. Little devil address they had there. And I send a letter to whoever the book licensing person was. I got a phone call, a letter to call them. And her name was Judy Fireman. And she turns out she had been the editor on the Honeymooners book that had come out from another publishing company and did her own book on TV shows. So she thought
I had that Honeymooners book around 85.
Yeah, she was in Workman Press, and she was the editor on that book. And she also put a book called a TV book she'd done on her own. But now she was working in charge of the book licensing division of DC. So she invited me up to the office. And, of course, you get there, and I don't know if you've ever been to the DC office.
I have,
actually. They have the Clark Kent was sitting in the lobby reading a newspaper.
When I was there, it was the Michael Keaton bat suit.
Oh, no. This Clark Kent thing. I went up there several years later, and they said, well, now he's up in the conference room. They also had the Superman busting through the wall there also,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of things. But so I went up to the office, and she invited me, and we talked about it. And she said they thought it was a wonderful idea for a Batman book on the show. I later found out, I found out about 5 or 6 years ago when they were re-releasing the original 66 movie, the Blu-ray.
Right.
And they contacted me from the company that was doing the featurettes, the editor of the DVD, to do an interview on the movie. So I went down, I did about an hour and a half interview. I think I put on like 30 seconds worth. But, and all I got was a copy of the Blu-ray, and I can't even watch it because I don't have Blu-ray. But one of the guys who was working on it, I forgot how he knew, but he said that turns out that Judy's boss, who was the head of the entire licensing division at the DC, was a huge Batman TV fan. He wanted the book out. So he was using her as a front. So he was helping her along, getting what she needed to do, and just using her as a front, which is fine with me. But it turns out this was at the time when they still had Mankiewicz doing the script with Sam Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
Mankiewicz was producing, and then Sam Hamm was writing the script. So you're talking 4 or 5 years before the actual movie came out. And I showed them this article I did on Batman for a magazine. I showed them a copy of my sitcom book that I wrote, and I mentioned the different things. Like she said, well, we have to research it because it's 20 years later, and there's nobody working there at DC that was there 20 years before who has any memory of the television show. All these actors were moved on, or they're dead, or they retired, or whatever it was. There's nobody left. And all the records were paper, so they were in storage. There was no computers or the records. They never transferred them. So they said, we're going to go check the paperwork, and we're going to look and find out who has the rights for the licensing for the show. And I said, you mean to tell me you and Warner Brothers are playing this gigantic movie, and with all this expense you're putting in, you don't even know if you own the show? I said, William Dozier could turn around, Fox could turn around and say, we still have the licensing owning rights. You're going to have to give them all the money.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're right, we don't know. We might have to. And that's, I think, the reason why they agreed to research it for me, because they didn't know who owned the rights to it. And they wanted to find out. They may not get sued later if they come up with the movie. Which shows you how stupid they were doing it. They were doing it back-ended. They never researched who owned anything.
Yeah, so basically you came along to solve two of their problems for them.
Exactly. And then here's the way funny part about the whole thing. I get a call from Judy, I don't know, about a week or two later. And she said, we researched it through the legal department. We found the records. And she said, our contracts were with the ABC network. We don't own the rights to the Batman TV show. We own the rights to the character. But as long as you get permission from ABC, you can have the rights, the permission to do the Batman book for nothing. Otherwise, it's 50% of the royalties is what they want. They don't take any money up front. They want half the profits,
okay.
My profits. So she said, well, if you get permission from ABC, all you have to do is say, you know, we have permission from DC Comics to use the Batman character in the book, and that's all you got to do with it. That and give them copies of the book, everyone wanted a copy with their name in it. So I said, now what am I going to do? So this is, I know, it was a Friday afternoon in February of 85. And I said, well, okay. So it's like 3 o'clock or something. So I'm calling up ABC. I said, what do I got to lose? I went through 6 different offices, the legal department, the book licensing department, this department, that department. They tell me to call Fox. I said, I've already been to Fox. Fox has nothing to do with it. So I said, try this one. Finally got to the last office, and the girl says to me, you got to call California. Okay. 3 hours early. It's even better if it's still there. It's earlier. Some, I don't even know if it's still there anymore. It's called the ABC Video Enterprises. Hmm. And I call the number, and I talk to the secretary on the phone. She starts laughing. She says, you finally reached the right office. This office was handling all of the syndication and reruns of the shows that ABC owned.
Right, and Batman was in constant syndication.
Yeah, but it was syndicated by Fox. But as far as the DC Comics was concerned, ABC had the contract with them. Now, here's what happened. DC, which was a national periodical at the time, did lease the rights to ABC to do the television show. All the licensing was done through the Licensing Corporation of America, the LCA. They handled all the licensing for it. They didn't have any in-house stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, LCA handled a lot of other companies, too, so they had a lot of other product, other shows and TV cartoons and stuff. Well, ABC had a meeting with all the executives, including Hog Bennett from the Star Trek movies and Six Million Dollar Man, a lot of stuff, and he knew Bill Dozier. Now, Bill Dozier, I'll get back to the ABC stuff in a minute, but Dozier originally was a network suit. He was an executive at CBS for many years. He was the head of the writers' department at Universal. He was the head of Columbia Pictures Television. He was responsible for putting on Hazel and the Patty Duke Show and all these other things at Columbia. He decided to become an independent producer, and he was working out of 20th Century Fox. He was working on different shows, including a new version of Charlie Chan called Number One Son, starring Bruce Lee. Hmm. And that fell through, and he wound up giving him Green Hornet. He did a couple other programs, called The Loner with Lloyd Bridges, a Western and things. But they called him into ABC, and they said, I'll get back. I'm going to go back and forth with the story, but they basically gave him the rights to do Batman. He was working out of Fox, and that's why it's syndicated through Fox. But to go on to the thing with the ABC Enterprise stuff is, I told the host story, she said, we're going to have to research the records, and we'll get back to you. They sent the letter, they sent it back, and they called me, I forget, but they said that we don't own the rights to Batman. I said, now what am I going to do? So I went back to DC Comics, talked to you, she said, well, they said they don't have the rights to Batman, we want it in writing. So they have it in writing. If they come out with it, ABC can't come back and sue them afterwards. Huh. Not that it mattered. Nobody knew anyone who owned anything anyways. So I went back to them, and they said, well, okay, fine. We'll have to send you a letter, blah, blah, blah. I still waited and waited. I finally called. She said, fine, look, I'll put you through the head attorney, a guy named Tom Emmer. And he explained to me what happened was. This is a bigger story than anything else. He said, we don't know if we own Batman or not. Back in the 1970s, ABC had a warehouse fire. Everything was destroyed. All of the records, all of the... I heard the original negatives of The Fugitive was destroyed, too. They must have found another set because they put them out
right on
DVD. But they said the original negatives were destroyed because the ABC had owned... They were doing their own syndication stuff. So they didn't know if they owned it. And they said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you a general letter of permission. If you have it, we have the rights to it, turns out. And then you got our permission. If we don't have it, you have your permission anyways. I just wanted two copies of the book, one for him and one for his secretary.
How many copies are you? Did you have to give out by this point?
My publisher, I had arranged. It's very strange how this all worked out to me. I was trying to do another book. I had done this episode guidebook, the Situation Comedy Shows, 153 shows, 11,000 episode synopsis.
Wow.
It's an 880 page reference book. It's weighs about 3.5 pounds. I'm from McFarlane, but. Long out of print, but back then it was like the original version of the Internet Movie Database for television mm-hmm. sitcoms. And I was trying to do a book on spy shows. And I figured we'll do a whole bunch of that stuff because that was coming back. So I solicited a bunch of different publishers for that. And this one publisher called Contemporary, the editor wrote back to me. She said, "Well, we don't want to do a compilation book. We want to do individual show books." So she asked me to call her. So I called her. I said, well, we're tracking this down. I was doing that. And I said, by the way, they're trying to get the rights to Batman. They go, Batman, we want it. They tried to do a Batman book. They couldn't get the rights to whatever they wanted to do on Batman. And they took the book sight unseen.
Really?
So I didn't have a contract until all this was straightened out, but I was keeping them informed. So I had a publisher all the way from the beginning, basically. Going into this, I just had to go back and forth. So then I went, I got them to send me the letter. I sent it back to DC Comics. She turned it over to the attorney. They were a little slow in doing it because they realized they were not making any money on it. But I said, look, I got a deadline. They sent me the letter. So I have all the paperwork basically saying nobody owns the rights to Batman. Go ahead and do it, you know. So then I turned that over to the publisher, and they did a copyright search and found that the copyright search with the government, the films were registered under ABC for the licensing, for the prints. Fox never copyrighted anything. It was a very strange studio.
Wow. So basically the story that you just told me is exactly what's held up these DVDs for the last 20 years.
But there's more. You see, there's more to this thing which came out of it. You see, at the time they were doing the show, nobody knew about reruns. Like I said, there wasn't much in reruns. Of old movies and some old sitcoms. And DC was still a private company back then in PP. And they were using licensing corporation. Adam West had a contract with the people involved here, DC and everybody else, concerning merchandising of the show and him getting a percentage. Now, I don't think it was deliberate, but the funny part of it all is that if you go back and you look at the merchandising for the original TV show, there's almost nothing. And I do mean almost nothing. You had the Viewmaster reels. There was a secondary version called the Super Eyes, which was basically a rectangular version of the card, sort of the round disc from the Viewmaster. The two different Topps trading card sets that came out. The novelization of the movie, the book. And there was a couple other, one other novelization book they had done, some made-up stories. They put a picture of the character on it. And I think that's it. There was nothing else from the show. Every other piece of Batman merchandise that came out at that time period had the cartoon character on it, the comic book character.
Right.
Nothing else. And that's how they screwed Adam out of his money. Because they basically said, it's not your picture. You're not entitled to the money on that. Only the stuff from the TV show.
Yeah, because he owned his own likeness, not Batman's likeness.
Exactly. But in him in the costume or whatever they were going to use, there was nothing much they could do with it.
Right.
And they basically said, this has nothing to do with you. This is the comic book character. So what happened was DC, or MPB, anyway you want to put it, they were still called DC, but they had licensed the Batman character for all the different types of merchandising, strictly with the comic book character on it. They left everything to the TV show, to the producers and Fox, to an ABC. The problem was, the producers, what little bit they did, whether it be the Viewmasters, which Fox was doing at every show they had, and the gum cards, every show had a gum card set. Other than that, basically, they didn't do any merchandising back then on that stuff from the studios directly. So they left all the licensing to DC and LCA.
Right.
So they didn't keep the licensing for the TV show. And this is where this whole copyright business with the show comes in. Because you cannot... Once the show is canceled, you cannot go back and relicense the show. It has to be current, and it has to be done beforehand or during the program.
Hmm.
Now, this happened. Now, as you, Universal and Columbia, Paramount and MGM used to copyright every single episode of every single TV show. Every Three Stooges from Columbia copyrighted everything. The Outer Limits on UA. Everybody had every single episode was listed with the government copyright office. Which was basically back then. You had to send them a $60 million film print, and I got a filing fee of like $10 or whatever it was, and that's it. Paramount didn't do it, it was UA. But Paramount and Fox never did. They did it for the feature films, but they never copyrighted the television shows, which became a very peculiar situation, which means that when the show was canceled, the licensing, you could do whatever you wanted with it. Unless, of course, it's a little gray area because Batman was a copyrighted comic book character.
Right.
When Star Trek went off the air, the show was canceled. And if you notice, now here's the thing. When they started doing all this Star Trek merchandise at the Trek conventions in the 70s and stuff, there was so much, you call it now bootleg, but it wasn't bootleg back then because there was no licensing left on it.
Yeah, there was a famous story about Leonard Nimoy getting really upset that they used his likeness on a European beer ad.
Mm. I think he got paid over there because that's his actual image as opposed to just... But I'm talking about the merchandising of all the toys and all the T-shirts and all that other stuff.
Mm.
In the 1970s, late 70s, Paramount was trying to make this movie and they were doing the licensing if they can or whatever they want to do for this movie. They couldn't license the television show anymore. because the copyright had expired because they didn't do it when the show was on the air. They never copyrighted the episodes. That's why everything came out, had that the Star Trek motion picture logo stuff on it, the different thing and the music and all that stuff.
Right.
Back in 70, let me think, what year was it, 78? Yeah, 78. Paramount went back to the original negatives of Star Trek and cut them. And they put on the Paramount logo, as opposed to the Desilu logos, or they added it at the end. They took off the scenes the next week, which were taken out, the bumpers, and the brought to you bys were gone. And they slightly re-edited the episodes. And if you check the end of the episodes, I don't know on the DVDs or not, but it says the incorporated 1978 Paramount. It was and it says recut negative. They went back to recut it in order to try to recopyright some of this stuff because they were going to lose out on the movie. Because everyone was coming out with Star Trek merchandise on the TV show with the reproductions of the costumes and logos and all that other stuff. That's why they never used the original Star Trek logo again on everything. It was always that new Star Trek logo.
Right.
This is what happened with Batman, you see. Because of the fact that the show wasn't officially copyrighted with the U.S. Government Copyright Office. When the show was canceled, the licensing rights went out the window with it. The producers of the show thought that DC was handling licensing, and DC thought, as it was a TV show, that's their handling of the licensing. So nobody bothered to follow up on it. And it died when the show went out, when the show was canceled. That's why this thing's been held up in the air so many times. Now, the feature film, people always say, why is the feature film always out on DVD or VHS or whatever it came out with? Mm-hmm. Because it had to do with something that was in the contract that allowed it to be adapted to home video. And that was what they refer to as alternate media, or a variation of those words. Back then, by putting it into a feature film contract, it allowed them to put out a motion picture film cut version for airlines. So you can run them in the planes when you're flying.
Right.
They ran movies. But a lot of times, if they were R-rated, they were streamlined because you have children in the audience, you don't want the R-rated picture running, so they used to cut them. But this wasn't cut. But the point was, this was a different media. They were allowed to use it in a different medium outside of just broadcast in the theater or on television.
So the way it was written, it was any alternate version.
And it was the alternate version, which referred to as the fact of any other broadcast version, is the best way of putting it.
Right.
Home video market's another broadcast outlet. So because of the fact there was an extra outlet added for the feature film, that's why that contract that didn't affect the movie. TV show didn't have it. Now they're airing episodes of TV shows as part of the stuff they throw you on television, on the planes. You can get a sitcom here and there, whatever. But that's why there was no provision for airing it. And, you know, the biggest thing we had back for me in the 1970s and 1980s was 16mm film prints we used to buy in the collector's market.
Mm-hmm.
For years, I used to be the projectionist at the Creation comic book conventions in New York.
I remember the Creation conventions.
My friend Jerry Beck, who was a big animation guy, he started as the projectionist there, and after he packed up and moved to California, I took over the entire projection system on them. So I used to run Batman episodes and Lost in Space and Star Trek and all the film prints. I had a big 16mm film collection. And I ran movies and stuff, and I'd go on the road. I took it to Philadelphia and Boston and a few other places. I would do Creation. I would do the film shows basically for nothing. They gave me a dealer's table. I'd sell photographs and videos and all kind of other merchandise and pay my way that way. But that's how we used to collect the shows on 16mm. You know, these were mostly the prints that were taken off of TV stations. Another piece of trivia. TV stations have two options to they buy a television show. Now it's a little different, but back then you had 16mm film prints. You had the option of a 7-year contract in which you buy physically the prints. You could do whatever you wanted. You can cut them up. You could do whatever you like. And at the end of 7 years, you throw them out. And if you want to renew the show, they give you another set of prints. Or they do a thing called bicycle prints, which is basically a 1 or 2 year contract where they physically take the print, send it to one station, and they can cut it or they can edit it. And then after they finish using it, they have to take the footage to cut out, tack it on to the beginning of the film print, and then within 2 or 3 weeks' time, they always had a length time, send that print to the next station who's going to be airing that print. So it went around the country that way. That's why every station had butchered episodes, pieces missing, everything was like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these prints would find a way once the prints were destroyed out the back door. People then, you know, the people would sell them or put them on the convention market sort of stuff.
Yeah,
or you get people who had access to the warehouse and they were making up a lot of extra prints at the studios. They'd go out the back door and people sell those out. No more. Everything's now on video. They can't do any of that stuff.
It's kind of the same way the comic book back issue market started with news dealers ripping the covers off and sending them back and then selling the comic anyway.
Yeah, the little paperback market actually is what they do with those. That's actually made more money with the paperback books now. But that's what you used to say, if you buy this book without a cover, it's a ripped-off copy. But comic books actually, like I said, killed the market because when they used to publish the books, it would only go to the newsstands. And most people don't remember this or aware of it. That the only place to buy comic books back in the 60s and before the direct market, I should say, up into the 70s, maybe in the early 80s, was from your little local newsstand or stationery store, as we used to call them. And they used to have the revolving rack. And they put all the comic books out, and eventually they got the slotted racks on the wall. And where I used to live in Brooklyn, I moved to Mill Basin afterwards, and which is the other side of Clappers Avenue, up beyond Cleveland Field. But there was a little stationery store in my shopping center right around the corner from my house. So I became friends with the people around the place, and I used to, once in a while I used to go in, I used to collect the comics. They said, let me just put them on the rack and pick the good ones for myself, because comic books used to go to the newsstands in bundles wrapped with baling wire.
Like newspapers.
Exactly. And they would be wrapped up. They had some paper around it, some cheap paper. But most of the time, the wire would always cut into the comic books, and the tops and bottoms. And they would buy them, and what they referred to is, I remember seeing their order form, 200 assorted comics. Now, you had no idea what you were getting. Sometimes you got 10 copies of one and one copy of something else, or you know, and the one copy you wanted was like issue number one just came out, was the one that was ripped by the wire. But that's how you used to get the comic books. And you used to have to go to three or four or five different comic books, newsstands, drugstores, stationery stores, and see what they had in the comic books, because they got a different assortment. And there was always some title that came out that you'd wind up saying, oh, what's this number two? I never saw number one, because it never showed up in your neighborhood. And, you know, so there's a lot of things you always had to miss out on. I used to go up and crazy trying to collect all this stuff, because you go to a comic book shop, you can buy everything all at once, but here you had to go looking. You know, so that's how it worked. And what the comic books was, is that anytime whatever comic books didn't sell, they sent back, and they were destroyed. So, like postage stamps that were offset, I mean, obviously they were done on an offset press, a printing press with an actual plate, when stamps would actually had value. Then once the plate was destroyed, as the stamps got older, or in this case the comic books were destroyed, the bulk paper, they printed up maybe 400,000 or 500,000 of an issue, maybe only 100,000 survived, and over the years they deteriorated, and, you know, like the old comics from the 30s and 40s and 50s. A lot of them get thrown out, they deteriorate, get rid of them or whatever it is. There's a lot less of them out there. But once they started going to the direct sales and they just kept reprinting the things over and over and over, and they made million copies of a book.
Right.
That it killed the market. So what happened to the postage stamps? Because they went to this computer-generated printing press that has no real metal plates. There's nothing to break. They can make as many as they like. The value of postage stamp collecting one is gone. You know, initially we go to really old stuff or something, but it's gone.
No, the supply starts to outweigh the demand.
Exactly. There's too much of it. Nobody says, who needs it anymore? It's not going up in value.
Right.
All the speculation's gone. You know, it's crazy that way. But that's another reason why Marvel and DC started doing quite crazy things.
Yeah. I still see now in the 90s, those books from the 90s are still, they're in secondhand bookstores today for 50 cents. You know, it's 20, 25 years later. You know, you assume that a comic that old would have gained value, but it's lost.
Because
it's not even cover price.
Everybody got a hold of the copy that they wanted.
Yeah, right. Everyone who wanted one got at least one.
Exactly.
And these are the ones.
There was no shortage.
Yeah, there was nobody left for the extra copies that wanted it.
Exactly. Do you, I'm going to go off the topic here for a second. Do you remember Howard the Duck?
Sure.
Okay. Howard the Duck, if I remember correctly, was spun off, I think, from Captain Marvel. The first issue came out, and I think there was a crossover in there from Captain Marvel, and it became such a unique, odd book that the book, I think it was a 20 cents or a quarter, went through the roof. And then, you know, it's like a huge collectible thing. All of a sudden, they found a huge stash of them sitting in a warehouse somewhere, and the value of the book just dropped.
Now when you wrote the book, did you have a full series of 16mm prints, or were you waiting for WPIX to rerun them?
I was very fortunate. I had a friend at the time who lived in Long Island. And Long Island Cable was, I didn't have cable in Brooklyn, but we had at the time, Channel 5 was running Batman at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was getting cable out of Long Island, and he was getting a signal from BSK out of Boston. And they were running Batman. But they were cutting different scenes for commercials. So he pieced the episodes back together for me.
Wow.
We're still missing a few pieces here and there. At the time, there's a couple of things I couldn't figure, I didn't find out until afterwards, but he lent me his videotapes. And that was the best way I could work it. Now, doing episode synopsis nowadays is not a big deal because the episodes are there, but back then, you know, you had to do the plots and whatever it was. So, it wasn't that difficult to do it, just to physically sit down and write a synopsis for, you know, 120 episodes. For me, the most fun part of the book to me was actually tracking down people to interview. And that's a story in itself also. Like I said, there's a lot of backstory to this whole thing, that the DVD thing to me is totally anticlimactic. Now, at the time I was doing this, and I got all the paperwork done, I went back to William Dozier and I said, okay, fine. I'm doing all the paperwork and all this stuff, and I'm tracking all this stuff down. He says, terrific. I was booking a trip to California in August of 85. And for 3 weeks, I said, I'm going to go out and do as many people as I possibly can, because the publisher wanted the book finished by November the 1st for that time. So I was at that time also I was in contact with Adam. And Adam was still living, he was now in Idaho, but he was living in California on the Pacific Coast Highway. Was it Pacific Palisades or something? Some of it was. Anyways, and he was writing back and forth. I said, I'm doing the book and blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, you know, he wasn't giving me an answer. Now, what I found out was that there was a lot of people out there all claiming that they were doing the official book. Now, my book came out in time, basically, for the summer of 86, which is basically the premiere year of the show. It was in between the first and second season, 20 years later.
Right, it's the 20th anniversary. Really,
yeah, it was about that kind of thing. It just worked out that way. But he was sort of holding back on this thing. I couldn't find Burt Ward for anything. He was no longer in the business. And I had gotten a hold of the Motion Picture Academy directory, so I had a lot of access to a lot of agents and other people and stuff, and I had the home address lessons I said I had. And I had already been in contact with Alan Napier, who was Alfred, long before that. I used to collect autograph pictures and write to celebrities and stuff, and I was one of the first ones I ever got, so I always had his home address. Once I had William Dozier on my side, I was able to get Yvonne Craig, and of course Alan went along with me, and I was able to get everybody else. Once I know Dozier was involved, that's it. You know,
right, it seemed legit to everyone.
And Dozier told me after I went to meet him, he was also the narrator of the program, so I'm sitting there listening to the voice coming out of his head. You know, usually only hearing is a disembodied voice. But he was impressed with what I did because of the fact that I had gotten through to all the so-called legal ownership of the program and straighten out all the paperwork. I said, you know, I know this guy was a network suit, and that's the only thing that's going to impress him to let me do this, is to know I went the legal way of doing it and follow through the whole thing, and that's what got him. He told me, he said there was 13 people that had come to him already and said that they wanted to do the book, and I'm the only one he agreed to do it for, because I had done the proper way of going through it. Now, there's been so much backstory to this thing, but I don't know how many people are interested. At the time, there was another character who was sort of dogging my steps. I had no idea who he was. His name was, David Heath was his name. I never heard of him. And he was going on telling everybody he's doing the racial rights of the book. And I later found, later on, this Heath called me. I don't know how he got my number, but he got me through somehow. And it turns out that he never had the rights to do the show. He had claimed he had done interviews with Adam and Bert and a few other people, but it turns out they were spec interviews he had done supposedly for Starlog.
Hmm.
And I wrote for Starlog, and I knew the editor of Starlog, and I never heard of the guy. So if he had done any spec things, maybe he did the idea of trying to sell him to Starlog, but, you know, I said, and then he tried to sell me his interviews, and I said, I don't want any part of it, because I don't know how legitimate he was anyways. But so I had this character going around, you know, and people say, oh, this guy called up, and they talked to him, and they talked to that guy. I said, please, you know. So I had that problem going. I got that out of the way. And I spent 3 weeks. I rented a car. I spent 3 weeks in California putting on like 1,300 miles going up and down the hills interviewing people, all different parts of the area, from the writers, the directors, the actors. I mean, sometimes we kept missing each other like crazy. I kept doing phone tag with Roddy McDowell for 3 weeks. Hmm. We kept missing each other. Finally, I had to do it over the phone when I got home. You know, some people like Cesar Romero, he was shooting Falcon's Crest at the time. He was flying up to Napa Valley. He wasn't in town. And then when he finally got back, he said he was so exhausted that he wasn't at the meeting with me, so we did it over the phone. I wish I had met him in person, but we did it over the phone. So we were discussing different things, and Burgess Meredith was shooting a movie at the time, and he wasn't available. So I had a friend who had interviewed him for Twilight Zone magazine, so he had a lot of Batman extra stuff. So he let me use his interview for my book. But I spent the whole day with Julie Newmar. I mean, we're still friends. You know?
That's great.
My birthday and her birthday is 2 days apart from each other. I mean, she's older than me, but, you know, she's the 16th, I'm the 18th of August. And we spent her birthday on that day, and we went to her house, we went out to lunch together, and then there's a whole story how I got the nickname Bat Scholar because of her. No, I'll make it very fast. We went out to a Chinese restaurant in Santa Monica, was it? It was owned by the Ma Mei's own people. They had this Chinese restaurant. She was friends with the owners. So, you know, she gets there, and she's wearing this. She, at that time, she was turning 52, so she was wearing this sort of like a chiffon dress thing, and she loved to skip through the streets. And she's like almost 6 foot tall, and she's skipping through the streets. I mean, she's as flighty as they come, but she's still also super intelligent, so I still like her. But she invited me out, we went out to lunch together, and we were supposed to do the interview, and we wound up not doing the interview. And then we're walking down the street, and she's, well, you know, okay, fine, you invite me back to her birthday party at night at her house. I said, fine, we'll do it there. But on the way, we were passing this curio shop, this gift shop that we saw, and she had to go in and look around, and she bought this big glass bowl. She wanted to put in floating candles in for the party that night. And, well, when we were there, the girl behind the counter recognized her, and she said, would you mind waiting a couple of minutes? Her boyfriend was coming. He's a huge Batman fan. He'd love to get her autograph. So she said, okay, we'll wait. Guy comes in, full motorcycle outfit. He had a motorcycle helmet with hand-painted Batman insignias all over it, with the yellow and the bat and everything else, and he freaked out when he saw her, and he had to sign the helmet. Okay, so that's nothing. Then she says, by the way, he's the one doing the book on the show. She said, well, you got to sign the helmet, too. I said, why? Because he said, you're the Bat Scholar. that's my handle on, I was using it for years. I was selling on eBay, and that's my use on Facebook and stuff. That's how I got stuck with the title, but I never would have called myself that. I just sort of used it. But that was a little bits and pieces. I mean, I've got a lot of different stories and bits and pieces of things of people. And to this day, I did more interviews. But so I got back, and I said, okay, I still don't have Adam. I don't have Bert. I still have more interviews to do because I had to get back to do them over the phone. Excuse me, because Roddy was busy, and a couple of the people I was doing. And I lucked out. I managed to get Ann Baxter 2 months before she died.
Really?
And I was in California for 3 weeks. I arranged to do an interview with Lee Merriweather because she did the King Tut episode. She was in the Batman movies as Catwoman.
Right.
And I wanted her because I wanted her in my time tunnel as well because I was doing the Irwin Allen fan club at the time, which is part of that. And so she scheduled me for an appointment to do an interview like the second or third day before I'm leaving. 2.5 weeks later, she was doing an episode of Hotel. Ann Baxter was the star of the show. Now, Ann Baxter lives in Connecticut. She used to fly out to California, do the show, and then go back home again. So I said, okay, fine. I anticipated this, but I knew this in advance that they were going to do this. She's doing the show with a hotel. So I had photographs made up for all the guests I was meeting. I had photos of the show made up for everybody. So I had stuff for Ann Baxter made up. And I get to the studio. Baxter had already left for home already. So I said, okay, fine. But she arranged for me to leave the photographs with the assistant director. So when Baxter got back to California, he gave it to her with my note, and then we wound up, she was calling me from Connecticut, and we were doing the interview, and then this was like sometime in September. She died less than a month later, 2 months or whatever. She was on her way to a hairdresser. She had a brain tumor, just
wow.
Exploded. So she never saw to see the book. I mean, other people I know got to see the book, and they surely died afterwards, too. So I got to get those in from people, but I was still waiting for Adam and Bert. And I remember this was around Labor Day, it was 85. And I had, going through the direction and things, I found Bert Ward had, at one time, a commercial agent to do commercials. God knows, I haven't seen him go to a commercial. But So I called the guy. Obviously, well, he's not representing him anymore. But he had his manager's phone number. So he gave me his manager's phone number. So the guy with the name of Larry Wolf. I don't know what about, you know, I never heard of him. But so I called the number, number's disconnected. So, okay, fine. But I explained everything to the agent, what I wanted, and that's all I know. In the interim, I had written to Adam. Adam never gave me his phone number. I always had, I always had to write each other back and forth. I got a stack of correspondence from still to this day. So I don't know all the autographs I need. But so I wrote to him. I said, I had Dozier, I had Napier, I had Yvonne Craig, I had all these other people, that I'm the one doing the book. I've been into mesh with this guy since 1985. Oh, a lot of stories about this stuff. To quote Bela Lugosi, when they said about Dracula, because no, Dracula never ends. For me, Batman never ends. You know, but it's
well, and part of that is the part of that is how we met is because of the Blu-rays coming out now. It's another.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
kind of step
thing,
of the drama.
Thing, you know, this thing never ends. It's like, you know, I've been so close to the Lost in Space cast. I was friends with Jonathan Harris for years and all the other people, and you know, but the Batman seems to just sort of float still there. You know, I mean, I was still, you know, I mean, I ran into, this was back in the, when did I run into him? Just late 2003, 2004, I ran into Eli Wallach in an appliance store in Manhattan when I was working. And so I went to say hello to him, so he gave me one other story, which I use in the revised version of the book, about
you revised the book in 2008, which is around the time The Dark Knight came out.
I had been revising it for 2 years. It's a long story with that crazy thing, and I'd rather regret it in a sense of the way the book turned out. I got a phone call. I'd been up late the night before. I was sleeping in. It was like 10 o'clock in the morning, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. I get a phone call. I was woken up out of sound sleep. Never forgot this one. And I had a voice who was asking for me. I said, it was me. And he goes, I'm sick and tired of signing your damn book and not making any money out of it. He goes, it's me, Adam West. Exactly what he said, basically exactly what he said to me. So he said he wanted to do a book with me. Well, not the first time he made that offer. He's double-crossed me before. He said he wanted to do his own biography on Batman. His own, you know, his Back of the Batcave, which eventually came out, but his own his own biography on Batman, the story of Batman and stuff. And he said he had a licensing problem because when he used to make appearances in his costume, he had to pay DC Comics a licensing fee to wear the Batman suit. Because they claimed they owned the license.
And I had heard around the time the Tim Burton film came out, DC Comics told him to stop.
Well, that's what they did originally when they did the Lone Ranger movie. They told Clayton Moore, take off the mask. I don't know if you know that story. That's another digression story. Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger, for years used to make public appearances wearing his Lone Ranger outfit, the mask, and everything else. And they were making this horrible picture back in the late 70s. Called The Legend of the Lone Ranger. They hired a couple of unknowns for the part. The guy never worked again. And not only that, they dubbed his voice and he was that bad. But
There was a lot of articles about it when the Johnny Depp film came out this summer because it was the last time until Disney's attempt that anyone even tried to make a Lone Ranger movie.
They did a cartoon series, but this is the first movie, and that guy Clinton Spilsbury never worked again. And the original, the replacement for Clayton Moore, Clayton Moore was the original Lone Ranger in the TV show. Then he had a contract dispute. They fired him. They hired John Hart. And then they brought him below. And he came, they straightened him out, and they brought him back. And then, but Hart showed up in the movie because they weren't going to get Clayton Moore because of the fight. But it turns out, that's a short story, is that the guy who owned the rights to the Lone Ranger, a guy named Jack Rather, and he had a fight with Clayton Moore over the years. They knew each other. They didn't get along very well. He was married to a woman named Bonita Granville, who was a big actress back in the days of Westerns. She was friends with Clayton Moore. She used to work with him in the movies. And this was a personal fight over the two of them because they wanted him to stop because they were making the movie and they stopped. It was a fight. So he took away the thing and he started wearing his dark sunglasses. I met Clayton Moore at a convention years before, not long after that. And then after the movie came out and the movie failed, Rather died. Bonita Granville almost immediately gave him back his mask. So the day he died, he was able to wear his mask again. He had a new photo taken and everything else. Same situation with DC Comics with Adam. He had to pay, every time he showed up in a costume at a convention, I had a couple of $1,000 a day. He had to wear in the costume. It's like, they sort of treated him like someone who shows up as Batman at in a public appearance event. You know, people in costume kind of thing. And so he wanted to do a book that he could make money off of, and I said, fine. So I said, well, you know, he's coming to me. He says, well, you know, you did the first book. and he liked the way it turned out, and he wanted me to do this book with him, to do his biography. And I said, well, I thought about it. I said, well, you know, we could do it in a way that, for example, I have permission to do it because I'm not, they don't own the show. He's going to do it from the point of view of putting pictures of the Batman logo and all that stuff, but they knew they were going to milk him for money, so he didn't want to do it that way.
Right. Eventually, when Back to the Batcave came out, he had his own stylized bat symbol on the
cover. Yeah, he did whatever. He even changed the costume when he even showed up on the appearances of the show because it wasn't really like Bat logo. But what happened with him was, I said, well, we can make it as the official Batman Bat book part two. You know, the Adam West story, whatever the title we want to call it. So we call it part two. We go over under the same permission rights as the first one. They couldn't touch us that way. We could do all the photographs from his collection, which he's putting on the DVD now, but all this other stuff. And I said, that's a terrific idea. And he said to me, there's only one stipulation he wants. He wanted $100,000 advance on the book. Now, you're talking 1985. He's not exactly been exactly, you know, Harrison Ford here. He's not going to get garnish that much money up front on a book.
Right, and in $1985 dollars.
Yeah, it was 86, 87. Yeah, so, I mean, and I said, well, you know, I thought about it. I said, fine, I have people I can do, I'll check into, I'll get back to you, you know. And I thought about it, and I said, well, there's only one way I could do this book. I wasn't going to tell him this thing. I said, there's only way to do this book is from the point of view is the Batman phenomenon affected his life. He went from a complete unknown to a total overnight star in 3 years to become a has-been. Completely. I mean, you know, he hadn't done that much movies and TV stuff before he did, you know, was it Robinson Crusoe on Mars and an Outer Limits episode? You know, and a couple other things, some spaghetti westerns. So he was a big night star, and afterwards he couldn't get arrested. Nobody wanted him because they said, you know, he put him in a movie. Oh, there's Batman. The same with problem George Reeves had with Superman.
Right.
And so I said, that's the only way I'm going to be able to do the book, and I could pull it off. So I went back to the publishing company did Doctor Who books at Lyle Stewart Publishing, and I went to talk to my friend, the executive vice president of the company. I mentioned this list. He said they'd be interested in doing the book. Then I ran in, that didn't happen, and then when it came time to do his book, he co-wrote the book with a guy named Jeff Roven. Now, Jeff Roven's been around for a very long time, and I know people who know him. I don't know the guy personally, but from what I've been told by people who know him, he's sort of not quite a ghostwriter type. He writes a lot of books for other people, but he's, when it comes to doing his own stuff, he's something of a, I wouldn't say the word hack, but his work isn't as good, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now, he did the factual stuff for Adam's book, the episode guide for the Back to the Batcave and a few other bits and pieces. The problem was, he doesn't do a thorough job on his research. He used an old 20th Century Fox press kit for the episode guide. And the press kit was written originally in the 60s to give to the TV stations when the show was still running, in fact. And then they packaged the whole thing together and gave it afterwards. They since redone the press kit, but they had episode titles wrong. They had synopses for episodes that were re-edited and some of the plot thing didn't take place. They had guest star listings for people who were not in scenes or scenes that were cut out or scenes that were never even filmed. He put all this stuff in the book. He didn't fact check anything. So he took someone, but he works, from what I've been told, on a flat fee, Roven. He doesn't work on royalties. So they paid him a certain fee just to do it, to put all the factual stuff in, which he never, and he just threw him something together. And I read Adam's book. I mean, there's nothing special to it. You thought you'd be getting a lot more Batman stuff out of him, and I don't think he's got it. I really don't.
Yeah, I've read it as well. It seems like it's going to be an autobiography, and it's mostly anecdotal.
But even anecdotal, it's not about the show so much.
No, it's more his experience.
Yeah, but see, I think when you have somebody like him, and I've known him for a long time, and he is what he plays on Family Guy. Is not exactly what you call super intelligent in that sense. No, I mean, that's probably why his acting career never went all that far, because he's basically, what he's playing on Batman is him.
Right.
And you know, personality-wise, he's a nice guy, he's a bit of a goofball sometimes, but, you know, everything else, he's letting other people, I think, run his career for him, and I think he didn't really know how to do it right. But But he came to, we went to do this again. Now, here's the other part of the strange part. This is a fun thing that happened at a Creation Convention Thanksgiving show. Was 80... After the movie came out in 89, there were big requests for a lot of the actors in the old show to show up and do appearances. Mm-hmm. And Bert and Julie Newmar appeared in this convention in New York, the big Thanksgiving Creation Convention. And I was working for Creation, so I got in, and I was working the film show, and I was doing opens and stuff. And I was still, I mean, Bert, I never met, but I was friends with Julie. And she was going on stage after Bert was going off. And Bert, at that time, was not the boy blubber that he became. I don't know what happened to him physically, why he let himself go, but...
he got he huge.
You know, it's a... You can see it now, the decrepit crusader and the boy blubber. But I'm just being, you know, 50-something years or 40-something years later, it's, you know, changed. But he lives a little. But back then he was still in shape, and he used to come out with the Robin costume on a hanger and put it on a standing valet or a folding chair to show the audience, like, there's his costume. And he was on stage. Now, Bert had, I had read Bert's book, which is something he self-published, which most people don't realize. They think it's a real publisher, but it wasn't. And he never fact-checked his book either. And I ran into Adam, I saw him just about 1990-something, or in New York, there was a Mad Magazine convention at one of the hotels, and he was the main guest. Why him, I don't know. But I went there, and I went to see him. And we were talking back and forth about Bert's book, because I had read Bert's book, and it was so full of lies, and so full of errors, and so full of half-truths, full-truths, I mean, no truths. I mean, he just made up wholesale stuff, made up everything you could think of in the show. And the problem with it was, on the stuff that he didn't make up, that was actual factual information, he got it wrong. And one of the couple of stories he would tell that they were wrong was he claims, in fact, I saw it in one of the articles that he came out from the convention. He's doing it again. God knows if he's on the DVDs what he's telling people. You know, I'm serious. I'm basically a film historian, a television historian. So right. For me, I would rather have the factual information, the stories, than some anecdotal stuff either made up or just telling them how it affected their lives, because it really doesn't make a difference to do with the TV show. But he told a story once how he was in the Batmobile, and the thing went out of control, and it went like 75 miles an hour, and he fell out. Because, you know, he didn't have a stuntman in the car, because Adam had the full mask on, so they had to be able to come. His stuntman, you could see, wasn't him. So he wasn't in the car all the time with him, or any time he was doing stunts. So I could see how he got hurt. I mean, he's only got the little black mask. Mm-hmm. But the thing with the car was, the car, according to the people who worked on the show who told me all this stuff, the car couldn't go faster than 40 miles an hour maximum. It was too heavy.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Not only that, they couldn't even get the thing cranked up to at least 25, the most, on a good day. They used to undercrank the car and speed it up. They undercranked the film footage and make it look like it was going fast, and it couldn't go very far.
Yeah, and you would see that when it came out of the Batcave, which was almost the same footage every episode. It's way undercranked.
Well, it is the same footage, because it was another reason why they did that. They filmed it in Bronson Cavern. The car could barely make it through without scraping the walls. There is a cave there. It's the same cave they used in the movie Robot Monster and a lot of other science fiction pictures.
Yeah, I know Army of Darkness had a scene there as well.
Yeah, so they put some shrubbery in front of it and stuff and things like that. So they undercranked it, because otherwise they would have destroyed the car coming out. That's why you never saw it again. But the car used to make a little speeding. They would just speed up the footage. So he says he fell out 75 miles an hour, and he almost killed himself, because he said, lucky we landed in like some sort of sand area where they were filming. But the car couldn't, if on a good day, reach 25 miles an hour. So he was lying about all that. That's one story. My other story is, which is the one he put in his own book, he got wrong. And I told this to Adam after I saw him, after I read the book, and he agreed with me. He really said, you're right. I'll tell you in a second. There's a story about the first Catwoman episode with the tiger. Now, you know the episode well?
Yeah.
Okay.
The
Lady of the Tiger.
Tiger.
Yeah. Now, Anna is not even in that scene. That's the trainer who happens to be in the costume, except on the close-up scenes. You know the tiger's not in that shot. That wasn't Adam. That was the stuntman. That was the trainer who actually controlled the tiger. They wouldn't let anyone near the tiger, because that was a real tiger. Now, that tiger was, you know, on a closed set with very few people. Just camera was off because it was like a cage put around the whole thing just to keep it getting out. They warned everybody if anybody had a cut. That's why they wanted no women on the set, because if they were having any kind of bleeding that time of the month, that the tiger smells blood, he's going to go crazy. Hmm. So they made sure. I got this Joey Tater, who was the was a henchman on the episode. He happened to be visiting the set at the time. And he said that while they were filming that scene, somebody or something spooked the tiger, whether it was blood or something else. He freaked out. And he started rampaging around the stage. And he wound up biting an electrical cable and was shocked. He doesn't know if the tiger died or not, but I think we probably would have found out if he did. But that was the only sequence that he did with the tiger. And it was a very dangerous sequence. Mm-hmm. There's a scene afterwards where they have Bert captured, and they have him suspended on basically a piece of wood, looks like a diving board, over a pit of tigers.
Right, over and they're retracting the plank.
The sand. The sand. Yes. It was weighing the amount of sand. No, they were tracking the plank, because the one with the alligators. That was the king.
Okay.
And you can see those were fake alligators with their heads bobbing up and down. But, no, this is when they actually had him like a sandbag, weighed out right. The amount of sand in his weight, and as he slowly, the sand dripped out, he would be tilted into the pit. Now, he claimed in his book that the director, who he claimed was Robert Butler, was in a cage with the rest of the crew, protected from the pit of tigers. He was suspended on this board over a real pit of tigers with a huge hunk of meat hanging over his head on a hook. And the tigers were reaching out of the pit and trying to get him to get the meat. First of all, I don't think anybody at the studio would have allowed that to happen for safety reasons alone.
Right.
But having said that, if you look at the scene, it's shot in a far shot because they wanted you to see Adam in the, there's a window, the far end of the set up on the top. He's like looking in from the balcony kind of look to it, looking down on the set. So they had a far shot of the whole area. You would have seen a piece of meat on a hook hanging over Bert's head. That's for one. Two, the pit of tigers is stock footage from an old movie. I haven't figured out what movie it is yet. It's obviously some color picture the Fox had, maybe one of these jungle pictures or Arabian Nights picture or something that they had, of these two or three tigers roaming around this little dark area of the pit. Because you can see it is a piece of plywood built to look, it's almost like a chimney looks like, that he's hanging over. Mm-hmm. You'd see nothing popping out of that. If there's a tiger, you'd see them. And third, the director of that episode was James Sheldon, not Robert Butler. And I told that to Adam. He goes, "You're right, it was James Sheldon." My only problem was that I actually was going to interview Sheldon, and he was shooting a movie in Canada at the time, and he said he was going to be back in New York to shoot it, and I never got back to him on it, and I would have loved to have found out about that episode more. But I never got back to him, because he since passed away. But everything that Bert has said about that thing with the tiger, everything said about the car and all the other stories he told me. The other quick story is that Adam, he used to say Adam and Bert used to go to all these different, date all these women, people seduce them on the road, they'd have orgies together, all this stuff. There's a 15, 16 year difference between the age of these two. You think someone 35, 36 is hanging out with a 20 year old?
Mm-hmm.
He made it all up. Now,
and that's what you're saying.
But now at the Comic Con, he's basically, there was an interview with him. They actually said he's now reduced it. It's now the car was going 50 miles an hour, not 75. but he's still talking. They printed it up. I'm laughing. I said he's still doing it. Now here's the quick part. I was backstage in the ballroom area with Julie Newmar, and Bert's on stage doing the car thing about falling under the Batmobile and stuff like that, And I'm listening to him. I said, "Julie, he's doing it again." Because she's heard the stories before, and I explained to her everything. But she said, "That was her episode. She would have known it, you know, as far as the tiger and stuff like that." She said, "I'll get him." So before Bert finishes his little stuff there, Julie grabs a microphone. And as he's telling his stories about the tiger and the car and stuff, she says, "You're lying to the people, Bert." She's off stage. Nobody can see her. All of a sudden, this voice comes out of nowhere, and she's lying to the people, Bert. You know the car couldn't go more than 25 miles an hour. You know, and there was a fake tiger. he got so red in the face, he took his little costume and stormed off the stage.
Really?
And she came out and she got an applause from the audience. I mean, because I had prompted her with the idea that what he was doing is he's lying to people again. So he's still doing it. So he just lowered the amount of the car speed. Now, and then after that, as far as books are concerned, I wanted to do a revised version of the Batman book. And in June 2000, I was working at Cross Street from Madison Square Garden, and they were having New York Comic Con the end of June that year. And it just so happens June Lockhart, Mark Goddard were there, and a bunch of other people I knew. So I was going to go there anyways, just drop in because I'm friends with them. But I had proposed an idea of doing... After the Batman book came out, there was a photograph dealer on West 3rd Street named Jerry Olinger. He's since moved a few times and since has closed his store. Jerry used to be an accountant at 20th Century Fox back in the 60s. And he would start selling photographs on the sideline, and they closed up the offices in New York and were moving all the operations to California. They were throwing everything out. Everything from transparency slides, negatives, and all the contact sheets, a lot of the shows that they had. He took it all. They were throwing it out, so you could take it whatever you want. He had all this stuff in storage. When I was doing the Batman book, originally said he had all these transparencies. If I identify whatever's in the transparency, he'll make me a copy of the print. That's how all these fancy colored bullet photographs I got for the Batman book came from him, a lot of it. After the book came out, he moved to West 14th Street, and he was cleaning out his warehouse. And he found the contact sheets of the second season Batman, which includes some photographs I didn't have, which I needed. So I said, now you find all this stuff. So I have all these great contact photos and things like that. And I said, maybe I'm going to do something. So I said, okay, what I want to do now, the Batman book is mine. It went out of print in 1993. And got the rights back to it. And I said, I'm going to try one more time to get this thing going into something else. All my photographs, all the original stuff from the 60s was turning yellow already because it was the old black and white prints and stuff and the contact sheets and stuff. I put it up all for sale on eBay. Mm-hmm. Of course, I scanned them all on the computer first. I said, I don't need the paper. Made a nice little bit of money over that. I got a contact from a guy in Florida, a guy named John Stacks. He put out a lot of garage kits on the Batman characters a couple of years ago called... actually, it's an ad in the back of my book for him. He's since sold the whole thing to DC Comics, but... he had the licensed Batman and a West figure, a few of these other garage resin kits. He told me he was working with Deborah Dozier Potter, William Dozier's daughter, on putting out the DVDs. This was going back several years ago. And the DVDs were, there was a licensing problem going on. She owned half the, it turns out, here's the thing. She got him, because he was doing the licensing on these resin kits, she sent him, they arranged copies from her father's collection at the University of Nebraska, where they came from, of all his personal papers from Batman. And it actually showed he did have licensing rights to all the Batman TV show stuff. He never knew. The show was canceled. He didn't know, nobody bothered anything. He had the licensing rights to anything to do with the show, even after it was canceled. He didn't even know it. But he had the paper. So he contacted her and told her that I'm the one who did the Batman book, and if she was interested in having me work on the project with them, and she was. So much so that he sent me over 1,000 sheets of Xerox paper of all the different files from my father's collection, with all the extra information, the original salaries, the budgets, the other casting choices. I have all the paperwork here. Plus some stuff on the Green Hornet, a few other things that were stuck in the file with it. But so I had all this stuff, and I was going to work on the project with them, annotating the entire series for them. They actually had several offers for the series. In fact, they had a $1 million offer from Broadway Video, Lorne Michaels' company from Saturday Night Live, was going to buy the show. And he was interested in putting up the DVDs. They were going to take it away from Fox and give it to somebody else. And he was the biggest offer. He was going to do this. Then the problem was that Fox had been renting the show to different networks, including the Sci-Fi Channel and TV Land or whatever else was running it back then. They never paid their share of the money that they owed to Dozier's family. So she sued them in court. And she was waiting for the results of the legal battle over the rights to Batman. In fact, it's on the internet somewhere. They're suing over the rights. So she wound up getting a settlement somewhere around several million dollars out of Fox for this. Then something happened. I don't know. I never heard back from anybody. I was, you know, her husband's an attorney. She was, he was handling some of the stuff. I never heard back on any of the stuff again, as usual. And next thing I know, nothing. It just vanished. She wanted all the, she was rich as money. She was not only Dozier's daughter, she was the daughter of Joan Fontaine, which just passed away. So she's multi-million dollar rich.
Right.
Her brother is Robert Dozier, who wrote the Joker episode, first Joker episode. He was a film producer. He was married to Diana Moldauer from Next Generation Star Trek. And anyway, so they, the family had money. It wasn't like this. She just wanted the money out of this. She was more interested in writing a book about the dog that saved her life when she was a small child than having anything to do with Batman. She didn't care. So, I don't know. Eventually what happened, she wound up selling her rights to DC Comics, to Warner Brothers, is what happened. That's why they got the licensing rights to do all the comic, 66 comic book and all the merchandising.
And that,
they had it a couple of years before that, but she sold out the whole licensing rights to them.
So that was the key.
That was the key, because she was holding the whole thing up, because Fox was negotiating with her. Now they had to negotiate with Warner Bros. Now you got Fox against Warner Bros., which was always a rivalry to begin with back in the 60s and stuff, the studios.
Right.
But, that was between Zanuck and the Warner Brothers, the whole other thing. But that was the whole thing that was holding this whole thing up, was this whole business. Now, in between that, I decided, look, I've got all this paperwork, I've got all this other stuff. I said, you know, if I wanted to do another version of the Batman book, and from what I learned, it's very hard to sell a reprint. It has to be at least 40-50% new material.
Okay.
Along with everything else. And I decided I wanted more creative control over it. There were certain things in the original book I wasn't happy with, and so I decided to go with an in-demand publisher, which was a mistake, unfortunately, because at that time it was called First Books, and then they changed and they were bought out, now they're called Author House, and I eventually finished with them. And the original people cared about what they were doing, and the new ones that came in, I found out from other people since then that they did a sloppy job with stuff. I mean, the book originally was 176, now it's like 400 something pages. They made it like an oversized thing.
Wow.
But the photographs didn't come out right. See, I originally made the photographs so they would be go flush from margin to margin. Mm-hmm. They put a border in it and everything got distorted. Mm. They took the proportions out of the photographs. They also made them too grainy. Not only that, every time they edited something else would go wrong. There's a couple of pages where they repeated the same paragraph twice, so the grammar's all screwed up. They messed up everything.
Now, is this edition still in print?
Yeah, it's still in print. It's an in-demand print, so it constantly prints when everybody buys it. It's on Amazon. I don't have anyone to sell as I used to, but I mean, there's a lot of things in there. It has a lot of material. I wish I didn't do any color in it because color was too prohibitively offensive.
Right.
In fact, the original color in the original book was actually farmed out to Hong Kong, and then they put the insert in. Then they paste it into the book, but
yeah, because that's just an insert in the centerfold.
Yeah, and that's because the glue dried out afterwards, and all the things fell apart. Everyone tells you the book fell apart.
I'm looking at my edition now that I've had since the 80s. Yeah. Mine's actually still in decent condition.
So is mine. I can read it. I'll tell you a very quick little thing about it. Everybody claims they got a first edition of the book. There's only real one. There's only 10,000 copies of the first edition. And you can tell the difference because the price difference is it. The first printing was $8.95. Everything else is $9.95.
Yeah, I have a $9.95.
You see, they never put in the print run in the book. The book ran like 16, 17 print runs.
Yeah, it just says copyright 1986. There's no edition.
They never put that in there. I don't know why they. I always had to ask, what are we up to now? Oh, it's up to 12th edition, 13th edition. They did 10,000 copies. They sold out in 3 weeks.
Wow.
It took them four months to reprint the next edition. And that was only 6,000 copies to cover the reorders.
Really?
It wasn't until the movie came out 2.5 years later that they really had a big surge on the book. They never knew what to do with it. They just wanted a Batman book, and then when they got it, they didn't know how to handle it. Just sort of threw it out there.
Hmm.
You know, we had a British edition with a different cover from Titan Comic Books in England. And they, in turn, put it out. I actually found someone. I was selling off some things in my collection years ago, someone in Germany, and he sent me a copy of the cover, like the same cover it is now, in German. Translated into German, which I've never knew we had a German edition. But I was, you know, they threw away a lot of it. I didn't get all that much off as I wanted. But, you know, they never knew what to do with it. The first movie came out, the second movie came out, there was still a big interest in Batman. They never bothered to put the book back on the shelves again. They just sort of let it die.
Hmm.
Well, a couple of years later, they were sold to McGraw-Hill, so I think they were finished anyways.
Well, I'm glad to know it's still out there. I'm sorry to hear that the new edition doesn't live up to the original.
Like I said, if I had tried doing this the last couple of years and changing with a publisher and stuff like that, with the licensing going on now, they probably would have tried to stop me.
Yeah, well,
now this thing is out. Now it's out there. I don't care. You know, it's whatever I make on it, it's fine with me.
Right, and
but it has all the budgets. It has all the salaries. You can find out what all the acts got paid, the deals that they made, and the other possible casting choices for other villains and things that they never used. You know, a lot of the villains that we see are not second or third choices. A couple of week ago or so, I said, look, I can't figure out. They're doing this whole DVD thing, and nobody's ever bothered to contact me to find out the slightest bit of the I'm interested in helping them with the project. Because every time they do a DVD set on any particular show or anything, they always have the author of the book come in and do it.
Yeah, and as you said, you were involved with the Blu-ray of the movie.
Yeah, I was. They called me into it, and just because Fox was doing it, and they got me involved, and I said, fine. And I couldn't figure it out, and I said, finally track this thing down. I go find an email address to find somebody, but I went to Warner's Home Video. I found their press list, and I contacted a couple of press people on there. And I got this one girl who wrote me back, and she said, well, this particular guy, I'm not even going to mention his name, who's in charge of their special projects, is the one you need to contact. So I wrote him an email. He wrote me back, and I reprinted his stuff on Facebook, what he wrote to me.
Right.
And the simple thing is they said that they're going a different direction with the project. And then he said that they're getting a total cooperation from Adam and his manager, and they're getting access to his full collection.
Now, from what I've seen on Amazon of the extras, it's really just all about Adam.
Exactly. That was the only thing they said, look, if you want Adam for the project, remember something, the whole cast is dead, Bert doesn't have much way of stories, right. And Batgirl's been cut out completely.
Yeah, well, there was an issue with her rights, too, because now, when all that wave came out last year of Batman 66, Vaughn Craig wasn't involved, and now we're starting to see that. That was a whole separate rights issue.
Well, I'll tell you, her likeness is something different, but I was actually working with a guy with the Figures Company in Florida. He runs a comic book shop down there.
A Figures toy company?
Figures. Yeah, it's a toy company, but he runs a comic book shop.
Right.
You know, he's just doing it on the side thing. He had me, I mentioned to him about the thing with the project and stuff, you know, as far as the rights. So he asked me, he said the problem that they have is that all the original cast members need to have their permission in order to use their likeness, is the way this thing works. And he had no way of reaching anybody else. Chief O'Hara, Commissioner Gordon, and Mrs. Cooper are all dead.
Right.
And unless you have a family member giving permission, they cannot do it. They wanted to do Alfred, but there was no way of finding his relatives. Now I got to.
And that's interesting because I've noticed in I'm reading the Batman 66 comic that DC Comics does, and I've noticed that the likenesses of everybody are dead on except for Alfred and Commissioner Gordon.
They couldn't use them. They don't have the family permission. I got a call a couple of years ago from a guy who did another writer who was doing, he was approached by Alan Napier's daughter. Alan had written his autobiography back in the 80s, and he was sitting around, never got it published, and she asked him to help him put it out from McFarlane Press, and it never came out as far as I know. But so I had his address. I was hoping to get the guy in touch with the guy so he could maybe get in touch with the girl's daughter, with his daughter, but I never did. But I did get Yvonne to give me her phone number because she moved to Lake Tahoe. She's no longer even in California. And so I gave him the phone number, you see. And because she's interested, I said, well, you know, if you get a license on the dolls, you can sell them on your website. She's got a website, and you can make some money off of it. So I don't know what became of it, but if they're coming out with her stuff, then it's because I got the two of them together.
Well, I know Figures Toy Company is doing wave after wave, so I'm sure it's coming.
Well, I mean, I don't know how they're doing different stuff. They've been postponing it for years. They were supposed to do the Egghead one last October. He's so far behind.
That's the next set. I've seen it solicited. So
yeah, I know. It's not exactly the same likeness of Vincent. Now, you know, even in the comic book, they did King Tut, but they couldn't call him what they wanted to call him. So they called him Victor Good. because Warner was Italian, Good. So they called him Victor Good, but they couldn't, you know, there's no licensing involved with all the family members because that's what they're concerned with. They're just taking somebody's likeness. That's why most of the villains, you know, if they can find relatives, fine. If not, they're not going to do it. But the main cast members are the ones that they have problems with. So,
well, from hearing all these stories, you've really changed my mind from why isn't this out yet to I'm amazed this is coming out now.
Yeah, but you know, my opinion about the whole thing is it's too little, too late. to put it out for such a high expensive set just because you want Adam West to promote it for you. The fans strictly want these uncut versions for these bootlegs. Now, the other part that concerns me about this whole thing, and people say, well, maybe I got sour grapes over this thing because I'm not involved. The only thing I would have done if I had been involved with this project would have been to make sure that this particular thing is it's working properly. Because for me, I felt that Fox has never cared what they put out on DVD. Lost in Space, they really messed up anyways. Mm-hmm. They took the scenes the next week off, put them on as extras. They took the, they changed the Fox logo years ago, but, you know, there's bits and pieces of things. They took out the bumpers. They took out the bits and pieces not edited properly, wasn't released for them. On Batman, when they run the show on TV, now even ETV, the Batman in color logo is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back then, it meant the show was coming on in color, so you watch it on a color TV set. But that thing with the Batman with the sound effect was actually part of, actually almost part of the opening of the show, that you really needed it. Plus, they cut out all the scenes of the villains in the first two seasons, little 15-20-second clips.
Mm-hmm.
So all that stuff has been taken out. I had the bootleg copies of some of these things, and some of the things, the clips are there, but the soundtrack's missing, so you got a picture of the villain, but no voiceover. Whatever it is, it's all sort of all messed up. So, in that respect, we don't know what Warner's is going to put out. Now, I saw a clip of Adam at the convention saying that they're putting back the, or at least mention what he said, that they're putting back the clips with the villains. But are they restoring them? If the Fox doesn't have the soundtrack, well, you're going to have the picture of the villain. I'm not going to say the narrator telling you who the villain is. You see?
Right.
Or the Batman and color stuff, or all the other things that's missing. Now, we don't know what condition Fox kept these things in. Fox hasn't taken care of a lot of their shows in bad condition because they really didn't care. So they say, oh, Warner's is going to put up this fantastic edition. It's all restored. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's only as good as what Fox gave them.
Yeah,
you restore all you like. If Fox didn't give them the missing footage or the things that they didn't give them, you ain't going to get it. And that's the thing that mostly concerned me is the quality control on this stuff. Put out an uncut version of the set. Maybe you put in if you find the better quality copy of the Batgirl pilot, a couple other things that you can throw in there with it. And that's it. You don't need the rest of these features. Why spend so much more money for something you'll watch once? Maybe.
Right.
And that's why I thought they charged with a $269 for his limited edition set with a little Hot Wheel car, which you could have bought in the store when it came out for a couple of bucks.
Mm-hmm.
They did a limited edition a few years ago. The Hot Wheels, the same they're throwing in because they couldn't sell them.
Yeah.
They're throwing in a reproduction of the Topps trading card set. They did those several years ago. Topps is sitting on a warehouse full of things. They're trying to get rid of them. You know, and what, did you hear the Adam West story? He's been telling stories all these years, the same thing. There's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
To spend all that extra money. Then they announced, and the letter that they told me, he said, oh, well, you know, maybe we'll get you involved if we're going to do re-releases on it. And a lot of people are writing on the Facebook thing, oh, they're going to do re-releases. Well, wait. Because they may be putting more stuff they're cutting out. Or they're going to lower the price. Now they're putting out individual seasons. You don't even have to bother with buying the box set.
And who does re-releases of television shows? Other than Star Trek, where they remastered it for the Blu-ray, I can't think of a single show that came out twice with different actors. Maybe The Twilight Zone?
No, it depends. Sometimes they change companies.
Yeah.
Sometimes they change companies, like they did with Sigmund and the Sea Monsters the first season. They never did the rest of it. They put it out again for the Rhino had something, and then the company took it over, or they did that with Little Rascals. A different company put them out. Or originally, for example, the first season of The Odd Couple or Get Smart was put up from Time Life Video, and then they put it out, and then Paramount put it out themselves.
Yeah, they also did, Time Life Video also did Best of the Muppet Show, and then Disney put out the season sets.
Bits and pieces of stuff when they strike out who owned the license and like to watch when Disney bought them up as they did it, but otherwise it was whatever the company. Other than that, they don't do that. But, I mean, if they're planning to re-release it later on, maybe. I mean, he's basically just brushing me off, and basically what he couldn't tell me was is that Adam is being pushed around by his agent for years, but he's got this grievance against something, and I don't know what it is, and in order to keep everyone else involved, he probably said, well, I don't want Yvonne involved. Yeah, probably Bert's not even on this thing either, I heard.
Yeah, it sounds like it's just Adam from what I've read just on the Amazon listing.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's just Adam, which I thought was strange.
I don't know how much his money. I don't know whether they paid him his money up front or he's going to make a commission off each box set they sell. But he's, they're doing it just for him.
But also, they're not talking to DC Comics. You know, you're not getting. You're not. Usually, there's a documentary, you know, Denny O'Neill will talk about what the comic was doing at that point, or
they have a
or
documentary
what, or just about the character.
Lee is going to be on it, and a couple other people.
Okay.
So
DC does have some input.
About. I mean, you know, they did stupid things too. I mean,
right.
Fox had on that, you know, documentary they did for the DVD, the movie I was on with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Lorenzo Semple, and they had director Leslie Martin. Lorenzo Semple was in his 80s. Leslie Martin, the director, was in his 90s. He barely remembered much of anything. I knew him when he was younger, but so I had more stories out of him.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!